And that wonderful sound is the sound of migrating tree swallows. They used to perch in the trees at Turtle Camp, the field work station I used to work at along the Mississippi River. The tree swallows would come in right at the beginning of turtle nesting season. And this week on the Season Watch podcast, you are listening to the Season Watch podcast, by the way. I'm your host, Charlie Mitchell, and we have an interview with Morgan Swingen. She's a wildlife biologist, bat biologist with the 1854 Treaty Authority, and she'll be talking about how bats use tree cavities and crevices in the summer to roost. And then after that, we have a marvelous interview with one of our partnering phenology teachers, Michelle Martin, who is one of our teachers down at Prairie Creek Community School in Northfield, Minnesota. Now, this week was a particularly exciting week to be way down south in Northfield, Minnesota, as John Latimer paid a visit to their classroom during the morning show on Tuesday. So we got to hear from some of the students, as well as their teacher, Michelle. Please enjoy, and we will start with the interview with Morgan Swingen, bat biologist. Get excited.
And joining me in the studio, I'm Heidi Holton, sitting in John Latimer's chair, your dream, right, Mark Jacobs?
I'm kind of lightheaded this morning from the power surge, but...
Here he is, our producer of many series with us on KEXE, and today we continue on with critters that use dead and declining trees in the forest. Mark, introduce us to our guest today.
Today we are fortunate to have Morgan Swingen, from wildlife biologist from the 1854 Treaty Authority.
There you go, Morgan. Thanks for being with us today.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about what is the 1854 Treaty Authority?
Yeah, the 1854 Treaty Authority is an intertribal natural resources agency. So we're kind of like the DNR, but we work for a couple of tribes in northern Minnesota. So we work for the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa and the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And the mission of our agency is to implement treaty rights for those bands. So under the 1854 treaty, the land in what is now Northeast Minnesota was ceded to the U.S. government. And as part of that treaty, the tribes in this area retained their rights to hunt, fish, and gather off reservation on that land. And so this covers most of northeastern Minnesota today, everything down by Moose Lake, up to Floodwood, Virginia, Cook, and everything north and east of there. If you're curious about the actual boundaries of the ceded territory, you might have seen the signs on roads in our area. You can also see a map of the area on our website. But yeah, so I'm the wildlife biologist here, and I kind of implement all of our wildlife-related programs. So that includes setting seasons and limits for hunting and trapping, running our licensing and registration and reporting on those aspects. And then we also do quite a bit of research and monitoring of species that are important to the bands. Those might be species that are harvested, so things like moose, deer, fur bearers, things like that, or species that are culturally important, things like wolves or loons or other beings like those.
So bats have been declining in recent years. What is the cause of that? Primary cause?
Yeah, so the main cause of bat population declines across North America, including Minnesota, is a disease called white-nose syndrome. So this disease is caused by a fungus. That fungus was introduced to the U.S. From Europe, and it was first found, the disease was first found in bats in 2006, and that was in New York State, and it has slowly kind of been progressing westward across the U.S. It was first found in bats in Minnesota in 2016. And so this fungus grows on the bats. It grows on bats that are hibernating while their immune system is kind of suppressed, and it disrupts their physiological processes and causes them to wake up and use valuable energy, searching for food, in winter when it's unfavorable. And yeah, that's the main cause of bat population declines. But that only affects bats that hibernate in caves, which is not all of our bats. We have some other bats that don't hibernate during the winter. They actually migrate, and that group of bats is more impacted by wind turbines, actually. So wind turbines kill estimated 1 to 3 million bats per year in the U.S.
And everything is interrelated, of course, right? So what does that mean if bats, what would be your concern if bats are declining?
Yeah, bats are a really important pest control group. So they control pests that affect humans, you know, things like mosquitoes and that, but also pests that impact crops. So they're also important for agriculture and things like that.
So why are forests so important to bats?
So forests, all the bats here in Minnesota are forest-dependent species. So our bats roost in trees. So during the winter, some of our bats are hibernating or migrating to live in other places. But during the summer, bats live in forests. So they are roosting in trees during the day. Many of our bats raise their young in tree cavities and crevices. So forests are providing habitat for foraging on insects, resting during migration, raising their young. It's really, that's where they live when they're not hibernating, is in our forests.
This is our conversation about critters that use dead and declining trees in the forest. Let's talk a little bit about what bats do when it comes to those dead trees and what they're looking for.
Yeah, so like I said, bats use trees. That's kind of their main habitat during the summertime. So they're roosting in trees. So we have two main like groups of bats in Minnesota. So we have our cave hibernating bats, and then we have our migratory bats. The migratory bats tend to be pretty solitary, but they're still roosting in trees during the day. Usually in the foliage, kind of on their own, or it might be a mother and her pup. But then our cave hibernating bats tend to group up and live in more like a colony during the summertime. And those colonies use larger cavities and crevices in trees for raising their young. And yeah, really they'll use any sort of cavity or crevice in any type of tree that they can find. Bats are pretty small, and even a semi-large group of bats can fit in a pretty small cavity or crevice or under the bark of a dead or dying tree.
So Morgan, I'm so curious. So how are you finding out all of this information? How are you monitoring what's going on with the bats?
Yeah, I was part of a large study about 10 years ago now, actually, on specifically the northern long-eared bat in Minnesota, and to learn about where they lived, we actually captured them in mist nets. So we use the similar type of nets that are used to capture birds, just really fine netting that's strung across an area they might be flying that they then get tangled in, and you untangle them. And then we would put little tiny radio tracking transmitters on the bats. Again, bats are very small. They weigh very little. So these transmitters had to be really tiny, and they're really difficult to attach to a bat because they're have fragile wings. So we'd actually just glue this tiny transmitter to their back, and it would only stay on for maybe a week. But we could then track them to the trees that they were using for roosting during the day. And we would go back at dusk and record how many bats were coming out of these trees that we tracked individual bats to.
Wow. Glue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was fortunate. It was one of the neatest experiences of my career to work on some bat surveys back in 2014. And we went to a particular area where we caught like 55 bats in 2 nights of 5 different species in 2014. Mm-hmm. And in the same location 5 years later during our survey, there were 0 bats. That's how much the population declined.
Yeah. So like I said, white nose syndrome appeared in Minnesota in 2016, and we just saw really, really huge declines after that. So it's definitely more difficult to study bats now just because there are so much fewer of them on the landscape, it's harder to catch them in any numbers. So researchers tend to use more acoustic methods to track bats. So there are special acoustic recorders that record the ultrasonic frequencies that bats use. Their calls can actually be differentiated between species with those recorders. So that tends to be the more common way to study bats now.
This might be a question for Mark and Morgan, but do we have enough trees for them to be roosting in out there?
Yeah, I would say roost trees really aren't a limiting factor for bats. In this study I was talking about where we were using radio telemetry, we tracked bats to all different species of trees of all different sizes and decay stages. And bats often would move roosts every few days. So that kind of indicated that there were quite a few trees available on the landscape that were suitable. They weren't very particular about, again, what type of tree or the size or anything. As long as it had some type of cavity or crevice, they could make it work as a roost.
Is there a relationship between the size of the tree and the number of females that roost? I know we had one tree, a big maple tree, that had like 50 bats come out of it during the roosting period.
Yeah, I don't know that we saw a really strong correlation. Again, there can be a fairly large cavity or crevice, even in a smaller tree that maybe was damaged or something. I think I counted 78 bats come out of a fairly small dead ash tree in a swamp one day. I don't think the tree size necessarily correlates to how many bats might live in it.
So we've talked about the decline. Are you worried about the future here?
A little bit, yeah. Bats are a tricky one. Bats reproduce really slowly, which I think is a major challenge after seeing a decline like this. So most bat species only produce one young every year. So compared to like something like a mouse that might be a similar sized mammal, those animals reproduce much quicker than bats do. So I think we are seeing some positive signs after the declines, but trying to like rebuild populations to where they were is just going to take a really long time because of that slow reproductive curve that bats have.
Seems like on the bright side of this issue, we have so much more knowledge now than we did 10 years ago. I mean, I can remember them saying that there may be 5,000 northern long-eared bats in Minnesota back in the, you know, like around 2014, 2013. And by the time our research was done, we thought there might be that many in Aiken County alone. I mean, it was pretty crazy, the gap in knowledge. So we know a lot more about them now.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And since white nose syndrome appeared in the U.S., there's been a ton of research done on bats, and we're learning more all the time. So yeah, it's always good to have more knowledge when you're trying to address major issues like this.
One question I've always had is the spread of it. I mean, do the same bats go to the same cave or mine shaft or whatever every year, or how do they get the disease? Do they switch caves?
Yeah, they can. There's some evidence that, you know, bats tend to return to the same hibernacula year to year, but the bats, even after they come out of hibernation, they can have that fungus on them. And as I mentioned, bats tend to roost, or cave hibernating bats tend to roost in colonies during the summer. So they're rubbing up against each other in trees or in bat houses, and they can actually be spreading the fungus that way as well. And some bats do return to hibernacula during other times of year as well, and pick it up at other times.
And this may be a dumb question, but is there anything that can be done to combat the white nose syndrome?
It's a great question. There's research on lots of options. It's just a really tricky problem because bats are hard to capture. They're very small. And then the environments that this fungus lives in, caves and mines, are generally extensive, perhaps dangerous for people. So there's a couple of different avenues that researchers are looking into. One is like potential vaccines for bats. Again, trying to implement that is tricky, but it is potentially possible at like large hibernacula where we have large numbers of bats gathering. And then kind of the other avenue is trying to treat the environments themselves, trying to get rid of the fungus. But like I mentioned, you know, caves and mines are very extensive, somewhat unknown, unmapped in many areas, can be dangerous. And I think we also need to be careful when we're trying to get rid of a destructive fungus that we're not damaging any beneficial fungi that live in those areas as well.
How do you catch the bats?
So in the summertime, we use netting, but there are also different types of traps that can be used at hibernacula where there's a smaller like entrance or exit point where lots of bats are coming in and out of. There's a different type of trap called a harp net. So you can just set it up at an entrance like that and collect a bunch of bats at one time.
All right. What a great conversation. Anything else you want us to know about the work that you do as a wildlife biologist with the 1854 Treaty Authority?
I just think people should be aware of tribal treaty rights and tribal ceded territories in our state. You can learn more about that lots of different places. One place is our website, 1854treatyauthority.org. Just become aware of things like that are out there.
That's great. That's Morgan Swingin, wildlife biologist. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Gosh, I love learning about bats. That will do it from our friend Morgan. That was a fascinating interview. I love talking about bats. I found out that one in every five mammal species is a bat, which is exciting. And also very exciting is this next interview with Prairie Creek Community School teacher Michelle Martin. Enjoy.
And now I've invited Michelle Martin, who is the teacher at Prairie Creek and has been, oh my gosh, how long have you been doing phenology with us, Michelle?
I probably should have prepared and looked that up before we got on the air today. I think 2017. Does that sound about right?
It sounds
possible.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. And you're fantastic at this. It's obvious that you like this because you just do such a great job.
Well, I think part of it is that we've learned as we've gone. And so every year we start to notice more things. I went to a workshop of yours way back in the day. And you said to keep a notebook.
Yep.
And that it was going to be super easy. And I was like, sure, sure, sure. But then it was. And so we started to keep track of just a few things. And then every year we started to notice more things and it got added to our notebook. And now we know what to look for. And then somebody says, oh, and I saw this. And we realize we haven't been keeping track of that either. So now we're keeping track of, I think it's probably upwards of, how many things are in our book, guys? Like 25, 30 things that we... Some years we see them and we remember to look for them, and some years we don't. But it's just something that, you know, it feels like old friends coming back now when we notice things that we're watching out for. I think our next thing that we really want to see is we just saw our dragonflies. So I think our next thing that we really want to see is our monarchs. So.
Oh, yeah. And it'll be interesting to hear when you see them because I'm curious. You know, they're a migrator, so they take advantage of a good south wind. Oh, the wind is pushing me north, I'll go north. So sometimes like the plants. Mm-hmm. So you've got hepaticas in bloom. It'll be 2 weeks before I see hepaticas blooming up there. There is that delay in plant life. But that delay doesn't sort of exist with flying things. Birds can shorten that time or they can lengthen it depending on, you know, which way the wind is blowing. You know what surprises me, I guess, about your reports, and as you described it, it was the same for me. Hmm. You know, my first years of doing phenology, I had 15 or 20 things that I sort of watched, and then I learned another one, and, oh, look at that plant. I wonder who you are, and and then discovering who that one was, and then keeping records of those, and, yeah, now it's, I don't know, hundreds.
And you follow the same trail every day, right?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I have a walk now. Before, when I was on my mail route, I would just be out driving. I drove the same 100 miles, so it was basically the same trail. But good phenology, really reliable phenology, is done the way you do it here. Mm-hmm. And that is, your focus is right here at the school. So your phenology happens here, plus whatever you students are bringing in from your own homes, which are basically in this general area. But you get a sense for what's happening in a spot. Mm-hmm. And how is it with the kids?
Well, I mean, I think, I know, because we talk about it, that they notice things too. I mean, I don't know how many fifth graders out there in the world know what a yellow rump warbler is, but a lot of ours do. and so I think that it's really exciting to see their eyes open up too, and to see all the things that they not only know, because you can learn things in a textbook, but things that they really deeply care about and feel about. And I think that without being out there, everything stays abstract. And so when we're able to get out, and we go out every Wednesday and we take a look at what's going on, and a lot of the times not much seems to be going on. Like our tree reports from the middle of the year, the winter, are not that exciting. But that makes it all the more exciting when things do start to have bud break and leaf out. We're waiting right now for our cherry tree, which we call Crabby, or our crab apple tree, sorry. We call Crabby to bloom. So it's probably about 2 days away. We'll see if the heat brings it out. So
how about, I think we can invite some of you in. What's your thing about Crabby? Are you watching the crab apple tree? Are you checking that?
Yeah.
And what's your name?
Caroline.
Caroline, welcome. And what else do you like about phenology? What is something that you really enjoy?
I like to enjoy, like, seeing the stuff change over the days. Like, yeah.
So this time of year, you like getting out and just seeing how one thing is. You have a magnolia tree here, don't you? And how's that doing?
Bud break now is like, it's starting to, the buds are starting to break, and we're seeing some flowers too, which is...
Your magnolia is close to flowering.
It's actually flowering, yeah, there's some flowers.
I have no magnolia at home, I must tell you, but my son lives in Minneapolis, and there's a magnolia growing just up the block from his house, and when we were walking his dogs the last couple of days, we've been looking at it, and you can see these buds that are like the size of the end of your little finger. They're just monster buds, and they're just poised. It's like Crabby. You're kind of out there waiting, looking, hoping that today will be the day, and it'll be interesting. I wonder, you know, as one of our students mentioned earlier today, the kids from St. Joe's talked about the simultaneity of the bloom of the Juneberry. So when the Juneberry blooms, poof, all of the flowers open on the same day. But does the magnolia do that, or does it open one flower and two flowers, and then a day later some more flowers? And
all the flowers kind of open like one by one. It's like one flower opens this day, another opens that day.
So. Okay.
And I think we saw the first one last Tuesday.
Yeah.
But it was just one or two way, like kind of tucked away where it was getting a lot warmer. And then by the time you all had, it's right outside the art room. So when you guys had art, there were more like 10 flowers that were open up at that point. And then they got zapped by the cold this weekend. Oh.
How cold did you get?
Went down to 20 yesterday morning.
Oh, so yeah.
I know it's nothing for you all. But.
Well, I worked on my car all weekend. And because of the work that we were doing, we had to snap a lot of the plastic panels off of the inside of the car. And plastic doesn't like cold. You want a nice 70, 75 degree day to pull plastic things apart. And we broke some fasteners. But we found new fasteners to replace them with. So it was that kind of a day. But 20 this far south, it was very cold. One year we had a similar situation, and I had baby ravens in a raven nest, and it got really cold and a whole bunch of snow came at the same time, and it killed them. It killed the babies, and mom and dad moved the nest to another tree. It's really hard to find a raven's nest. You have to be very patient and spend a lot of time in the woods. But I managed to locate their new nest, and I was by it a week ago or so, and there are babies in there now, so I hope they got through this cold spell. But there was no snow with our cold. It rained, fortunately, not cold. Yeah.
At my house, there was a little bit of snow.
Oh, yes. Okay. In this last storm.
No, this weekend, I woke up and I saw snow falling.
No.
And I was surprised, and I'm like, damn.
That's right. You know, when I got up Sunday morning, I noticed my son has a big sugar maple in his front yard, and it was just draped with snow, and I thought, well, that's a pretty picture, but it really is depressing. Oh, what did I want to ask you? Oh, the tornadoes that came through, they were not far from here?
Near Strand. That's where I heard. I heard the tornadoes were in Near Strand area.
And how far is Near Strand from here?
Isn't it like 20 minutes?
It's so, right where the Big Woods Park was, where we had been the week before.
Oh, okay. Anybody from the school here live in that area or have no people who live down that way?
We had a couple classmates that were close, but nobody that was affected by damage. So
yeah.
I got really close.
Yeah.
It was close to your house?
Yeah.
And help me, you're Theo?
Yeah.
Okay. Theo says it was close to his house, so it was kind of exciting. And anybody else? Something about phenology that you like?
I enjoy the, like, how we get to talk and we could be on the radio. And I like coming out with you out and looking at stuff. So it's just, like, makes my day whenever we get to go out on a walk with you.
Well, you've got an excellent teacher who is as adept at the woods as anybody I've met. So, yeah, it's fun to come. I love it. Children always energize me. I love to be out with them. But at the same time, your teacher is really magnificent. You only have one, so you don't know from the whole picture, but she is one of a kind. She is singular in her passion for teaching and for her passion for phenology. And I can't help but think that it is going to, all of you will, you know, you may not become phenologists as you grow, but you'll always be aware of nature. You'll always be looking at what's happening around you.
I'm still wondering about the walnut syrup. Who is the one that made
right.
the walnut syrup?
Who's our walnut syrup person? Here we are.
It's John Latimer.
Tell us your name.
My name is Silas.
Silas. Okay. And tell us about walnut syrup.
So it's literally maple syrup, except we have to tap the walnut syrup. It's a lot more vanilla-y and smoky. So we made chicken and waffles and had it.
Wow.
So it like gave it the smoky flavor.
So you tap the walnut tree and collect the sap.
Yep.
Do you mix it with maple sap or do you?
I didn't, but it might be a good idea because you get a lot less of it. There's a lot less walnut sap than maple sap. It runs slower.
Okay. Yeah. A lot of people and one of the guys who was used to be on the air with us a lot, a fellow named John Zazada, used birch and made birch syrup and birch candy. And it had a really different flavor from maple.
It's kind of spicy, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it has like some high notes in it.
Yes,
too.
It does. Yeah. It's not at all, I mean, it's sweet, but it's got, like you say, it's sort of a spicy, I like high notes. That's a good descriptor. So how often, how long has your family been doing walnut syrup?
This first year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I really like the experiment that's going on there. Your parents must be very intrepid. Or was this something you brought to them?
I brought it to them.
Oh, good for you. Silas, you're my kind of guy. Hey, we should tap that tree and see what happens. All right. Well, Heidi, there's your answer on walnut.
All right.
And we're going to turn it all back to you.
Okay, and that will do it for this week's Season Watch podcast. Thanks so much for listening. As always, please send us a voice memo via SpeakPipe. Thank you to Jonathan Jongsma for the recording of the tree swallow. Thank you, Morgan Swingen and Michelle Martin, for being on this week. And thank you all for supporting the podcast.